Ok, estamos aquí entonces con Jason Jersinovich, Global Head of Marketing Innovation de Avas Cognitive en New York, en su primera visita a Chile. El señor Jersinovich está dedicado a la inteligencia artificial, es un líder de cómo usar la inteligencia artificial en temas de marketing en el mundo. Está en Santiago para conversar justamente en este minuto, debería estar entrando a Icare. Nosotros conversamos con él un poco antes.
Se sienten los aplausos.
Se sienten los aplausos, así que tienen la oportunidad de escucharlo en vivo mientras el señor Jersinovich habla en Icare en estos minutos. Esperamos que esta conversación sea incluso mejor que su presentación en Icare.
Seguro.
Estamos aquí con Fernando Zavala. Hi Jason, how are you?
Very good today. Thank you for having me.
Great. Great to have you here in Chile. You've been in digital marketing for 20 years.
Since the beginning.
Since the beginning.
In 98. All started.
Well, actually, I started a little bit before that, you know,
93, 94. Okay.
And right when we were first building mobile websites for AOL, if you remember AOL.
Yeah, I remember that.
Time Warner, I was starting to do some interesting stuff around this opportunity of building digital advertising. And then it was, you know, how
very
do we take...
Very small market.
Very small, yeah, but how do we take traditional advertising? And I started in a big agency. Backer Spielvogel Bates, you might know them, very famous in the Chrysler building, 10,000 people in the building.
Madison Avenue.
The whole thing, you got it. And I was the little guy in the corner, there's three of us, you know, we called it mixed media back then. You know, it was
mixed media.
Yeah, before even digital, before
digital. Not even digital media.
Not even interactive yet. And then around 95, 96, it started to mature and, you know, we all realized, hey, this opportunity of knowing who people are, hey, it's a one-to-one opportunity. And we were saying it was one-to-one back then. But it wasn't really one-to-one. It was really about buying audiences. And you would use digital to buy an audience. And you would have a better understanding of who they were. And you'd try to serve something to them that was more important.
This was mostly banner advertising
at
the time?
Yeah, back then it was mostly digital advertising, which they called banners or display.
Double click, all those guys.
And then search came into being, you know, around that time. And that was the real one of the first real breakthroughs is that you can understand what people are seeking because they tell you. They say, I'm looking for detergent or for a soap or, you know, or for Adidas pair of, you know, trainers or what it is. And that gave you a bit more understanding of who these people were and what they were about. And that was the big shift from traditional advertising to digital advertising is a better understanding of the people. And that was led because of the fact that the internet was exploding. You're seeing more and more people going on the internet. You're seeing the ability of the devices to enable the internet to happen in your hand, on a tablet, on a fast-moving computer that was portable, laptops, you recall. And this was all new. So out of that came these breakaway, you know, the horsemen that took over. You know, you've got the Facebooks and the Googles and Amazons that really saw that opportunity.
That was second phase of development after,
yes,
because
exactly.
There was
the crash.
Yahoo.
You had the crash, right?
Yahoo, yep. And then later Google came in.
Yeah, kind of skipped a little bit there. But, you know, so we built up to the hype, you know, around 2000. And then obviously the bubble popped and there was a reset. And then the focus was around, well, you know,
making money.
Make some money. And these ideas have to be real ideas. And that's when, you know, the social media thing became really important because, you know, the technology was there, enabled us to connect in that capacity. We wanted that as consumers, and we embraced that. And you could see now we live our lives in digital and social media more than we watch television. And you're seeing that even more with the younger people who are spending more time on devices, connecting devices, and even, you know, not even watching television. The never had a cord is a new new segment,
it's,
right?
It's not even
not
cord,
the cutters.
Not the cutters. Yeah.
Never cords.
Yeah.
Never cords.
So let me ask you something. So I believe I have the sense that even though the methods have changed a lot since you started, so in the last 20 years, the basics of how to relate with the customers and how to sell things to customers are basically the same. Can you talk a little bit about
more?
Yeah,
I mean, we're in the art of persuasion. Okay. We always have been. And nothing's changed since you know, 100 years ago when we started doing this stuff, right? And it was about trying to get people to want your product or want your service. The thing was that a lot of it was wasted back then because you would have one message that would go to everybody or maybe a small number of messages, which you would go out on broadcast. Everybody would watch the television commercial, the TVC, the spot, and everybody would get that one message. And they'd often joke, half the media spend is wasted. You just don't know which half, right? That was what was said. And then the idea was, well, with digital, we can be much more targeted. you know, there was
micro segmentation.
That's where we are now. Yeah, super micro, down to the audience of you, to the audience of Jason, and really know who I am. But you know, this was not a new thing. There was this thing called direct marketing, which you know is not a new thing, and that was been around for a long time.
Nice.
Typically in mail, and even you know early examples of that from a long time ago, catalogs that would be sent to you.
Yep.
You know, that's an early example of direct marketing. The segments weren't as small. Now, you know, because of the fact that technology has continued to evolve, Moore's Law has not gone away, so we're on that curve, and every 18 months, it's amazing what happens. I mean, look at our phones. These are supercomputers that we carry around in our hands. We have access to high-resolution streaming video. We can talk to each other in multiple languages. It's almost magic that happens now. Mm-hmm. So with that, we have sort of the rebirth of artificial intelligence, and that came about for a couple reasons. One, that there was the dark
cloud,
period.
The cloud was
the cloud was yes, very good point.
And,
yes.
And processing power and all the technology that comes, you know.
And also data.
Data.
And that's can you elaborate on what were the factors that made artificial intelligence?
So you had a dark period, right? You had a dark period where everybody was saying, they called it AI winter. There was actually a couple of them. You know, in the 50s after Turing and the scientists were saying, oh, they're going to have machines that are sentient and talking. There was big expectations and everybody said, oh, it's right there. It's next year is going to be the year. Or 10 years out, we're going to have machines smarter than us. That was not the case. Expectations were too high. And it took the evolution of technology, specifically cloud computing, the access to an API economy that enabled us as developers to use these APIs to query in real time, billions of times a second now this is happening. Every experience that we have on social media, on Facebook, on Amazon, on Tinder, on you know all these different things are AI driven. So so we now live in that world. But you know it started because of
Uber,
all of this stuff. Yes. So it started because the cloud became ubiquitous because we had access to these machines. And also, think about it, we also embraced social media, and that enabled us to have a large amount of what I call the digital exhaust of who we are as people. Mm-hmm. So we. We like stuff, we post, we comment, we talk.
That's why the cloud is so important, if you agree on that, because you have access to all that data that before the cloud was distributed on the servers of Amazon or whoever.
So now access to that
all the information.
As marketers, now we have access to that. We have access to your information as a consumer because you've given us that permission, at least. You think you have given us that permission.
Okay. Some people. I agree. I agree.
I'm going to touch on that a little bit later.
Because you go through all the terms and conditions and you read it all
before you say it.
No, we don't. But that data that came out of social media and that came out of the proliferation of devices, coupled with cloud computing and the access to these APIs, gave us as not just marketers, but everybody in the world, incredible tools to allow us to understand these insights about people at a very personal, intimate level.
Plus mobility, that you're creating data the whole
time.
On we
go, everywhere we go.
Every 5 minutes.
Huh? Yeah, we forget that our cars have these devices now too. And even when I flew in this morning, I saw the warning about facial recognition. I was being profiled on the 75 million Americans who come through, and my face sucked. It was okay. They didn't arrest me. I was all right.
Let me ask you a little bit. So you were saying about data and all the power that comes through with the capacity to analyze these huge amounts of data, and as somebody said, you know, a couple of years ago, with great power comes great responsibility. So what do you think about the whole mess that was said about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica? And so from your perspective as somebody that works with data and, you know, builds tools to explore this data and to analyze and make, you know, something about it, what do you think about it? Do you think that who's guilty and is there someone to blame?
Well, I think all of us are complicit.
Okay.
Right? And it's not...
We are guilty.
It's not about...
Gonzalo, you're guilty. I'm guilty.
Guilty. And obviously, Cambridge Analytica crossed the line, and they did it with a nefarious intent.
Okay.
And so they're, if you have bad agents or people that are choosing to have an outcome that isn't necessarily what you signed up to do, that's a little different, right?
Okay.
But the truth is, it was very loose. Privacy was very loose on Facebook for years. And that was one of the reasons that advertisers liked it, is because you had access to this data. You had access to people, and you enabled you to have that micro segmentation where you could find that perfect alignment with your target audience and give them directly the message that aligns with what they need to feel or to think they feel in order to buy or want your product.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difference is those guys, A, took it out of the system and purposely had an outcome that wasn't what we all expected the system to support. You know, there was a nefariousness to that and a desire to change the world in a way that wasn't aligned with, you know, our expectations about the use of our data. And that's, I think, where the challenge was.
They were too creative, basically.
Well, many people did the same thing, and I talk about this a lot. Don't you think
there's a little potential to have a big problem with this?
There is a big problem right now. There's no potential. It is now.
Our faces, they have our fingers.
They know what we like. And from that data, you can infer a lot of things. Not only who you vote for, your sexual preference, you know, who your family are, who your friends are. Where you are and who you're with. All that information's there. And there's an attack on our privacy right now. So this is where it becomes an imperative for marketers, leaders, to do the right thing and to lead with a code of ethical conduct. And that's going to separate the brands that survive from the brands that go away. You know, we have Havas have this survey, global survey called Meaningful Brands, and we interviewed 300,000 consumers all around the world. Mm-hmm. We've done this for 10 years. And every year for the past 10 years, an increasing number of them do not care about brands. And I think, maybe it's 79-81%, something like that, of the brands could go away right now and consumers would not care. And so you think about that in your life, maybe BlackBerry, maybe Kodak, Toys R Us, maybe there's others that have gone away and are gone. And do you shed a tear? Maybe. Mm. Maybe people love their BlackBerries, maybe for BlackBerry. But my point is that you have to have a value relationship with the brand to survive. And there's the 20% that do. And increasingly, that's about appropriate use of technology and privacy and management of people's privacy.
But don't you think there's a little bit of cynicism from the consumers? And I'm a consumer myself.
Yes.
Because we love, you know, being watched, being seen, you know, show everyone what we're doing, what we're eating and, you know, visiting. So so from my perspective, there is some desire of consumers to be watched, to be seen.
Well, we live in the world of social media now. We embrace it. We dive into the ocean with both feet and swim every day in that ocean of that, and we love that. And that's, you know, one of the things is the platforms are designed very well. Yeah. They're very addictive. You know, you get that red dot that tells you that, you know, that your post was liked by 600 of your closest friends, and you get a dopamine rush. It's similar to when you finish a run.
Exactly.
And that's a natural organic thing we have as humans is to be appreciated, to be liked, to have that constant reference that I am doing great things. And so the platforms are engineered to do that. I think the challenge is they need to be engineered for our well-being too. And there's studies that show that there's a downside to social media, you know, about well-being, about people getting depressed because maybe they feel they don't have the life that everybody else shows because everybody only shows the perfect life that they live. Mm. When they're out to dinner with their friends wearing their nice clothes and they're at the fancy restaurant at the nice club.
So there's a TV show that shows that.
And they don't tell about the time they missed the bus and they're standing out in the rain and they're late for work and their kids are screaming at them. You don't see that part.
Yeah.
But we all live that part. But so there's the, what is reality is the question. Because now we see this version of reality in social media, and that is a version of the reality that we live. But it is not all of the reality. It is a bubble. Right. Mm. And so you couple that with micro segmentation and the ability to reinforce beliefs that you may have that may not or may not be true. And you could create emotional responses and outcomes that, you know, maybe even we as individuals did not intend nor want. And we saw that with Brexit. We saw that with our election in North America, where a subset of people were suggested messages that were false and they were propagated as inaccuracies or fake truths, but people believed them and then chose to do something like vote. Mm. And so that's when you see the outcome potentially being for a bad thing because you could see people making the decision to vote for somebody or vote for something
based on wrong information.
And that's living in the bubble. And so that's where there's complicity, which we need to attack.
Estamos conversando con Jason Jerzinovich, Global Head of Marketing Innovation de Havas Media, Nueva York. And how is this going to change or how is it changing marketing? Because you work in a marketing agency, in an ad agency. I was talking to a friend, actually, who's a producer of TV commercials, and he told me that his business has shrunk a lot.
Yes.
Because they're doing just things for the...
Well, there's two factors here that are affecting the business.
How is marketing being changed by
most importantly, you're seeing the growth of the digital platforms, the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples, continuing at this trajectory.
And the market share is increasing.
And the Instagram. So that's growing up. Now, 80% or something like that of every digital dollar goes to those companies. Okay. Sometimes you see some studies that say Google and Facebook get most of that, right? So you're fighting over that last fifth. All the rest of the universe is fighting over that last fifth.
That's of the growth of the
of total growth of digital growth. Advertising. So any new incremental new dollar that is spent.
How much is digital advertising compared to traditional advertising now?
You know, I don't know the LATAM statistics on it, but what we're seeing is a flat line or a decreasing amount of people consuming traditional television. You're seeing a direct line that's almost like at a 45-degree angle that's shooting up in terms of digital content consumption. And you go back to the aforementioned discussion of people not watching traditional television, never having cords in their house to watch TV. There are must-see things like sports and, you know, maybe the Oscars and award shows and you know, Olympics and maybe World Cup, and there's things that we will watch, right? But increasingly those are tentpole things that have a very high number of reach and are the, you know, the old school traditional advertising nirvana. However, in order for us as marketers to talk to people in the way that they are become accustomed to, because we as consumers live in this digital world, we need to create the right experiences in these digital platforms. And that's where the growth is. That's why I am not, my business is not decreasing, it's going up. Yeah. I am super busy because everyone wants help.
You're
with
like
that.
The China of advertising.
So what that means is you need
15 years ago.
you need to help them understand the imperative to do the right thing. And so we recommend a series of ethical guidelines in terms of doing this. Very simple things, you know, make sure you tell people what you're doing with their data, make sure they have the ability to manage that preferences, to opt out, to opt in, and they understand the benefit of using that data. And there's a transparency or an authenticity in that is essential. Because if you don't do that, people will figure it out. It's not like you can hide anymore. As you said, we live in this world where the eyes are watching. So you need to be transparent and authentic. You need to make sure the value exchange is really understood and not to fake being human.
Okay. And what about the structure of the industry? Are agencies being more important in this or less important? Are they being
both
disintermediated?
There's a disintermediation of the traditional agency business.
Specialization
the growth of specialization is increasing. So the desire to manage the digital side of this, the CMOs are still seeking guidance of professionals like us to help them understand how to navigate that. However, we're being disintermediated because Facebooks and Googles have self-service entities. Mm. And even Amazon, we're seeing this now, who quietly have assembled $2 billion of revenue in advertising from nothing a couple years ago because they're moving fast and are very focused. And if I'm an advertiser, I'm a CMO of a company, I can go direct to these platforms and do some of the work or all of the work that my agency used to do. So that causes us to be disintermediated. How we are able to help them is we say, well, here's the insights from the data that helps you tailor that message, that helps you make an emotional connection. Now we take that brand platform idea and bring it down to the individual level that we as consumers expect. And so that's why the digital side of it is growing like crazy. And and there's this intent or desire to get it to the point where it is a personal thing, where you're marketing to me as the audience of one, the audience of Jason. And that means some of the stuff, you're not going to sell me a car because you know I just bought a car. So that's the big difference is, and in the past, automotive manufacturers would be trying to sell me, regardless of the fact that I just bought one. I would still see all these ads. And I'm like, you just wasted all this money, right? So now they would say, okay, no, maybe we don't show him auto ads. We show him something for his kids, maybe, or trainers for my shoes, or my football team, or new tires, or a special vacation.
How do you so let's move forward 5 years from now, or I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years. How do you see the future? How is this marketing going to change or going to be disrupted in the next years?
So there's a couple of key things that are happening right now. You're seeing GDPR launch May 25th, I believe, in Europe, which is, you know, general privacy protections being launched at the European EU level. So they're leading with a very strong opinion on that.
And more regulation.
More regulations happening in Europe.
Okay.
US, no, we do not have that. We have less regulation and we have increased commoditization of our individual privacy.
Okay.
So they just opened up all the cell phone things and now you're getting all these robocalls calling the cell phones and it's the opposite. There are pockets of people who are figuring this out and you saw that in terms of Congress and House of Representatives pulling up Zuckerberg onto Congress and saying, hey, what about this abuse of privacy? What about this? And the frightening thing is they're not understanding how fast the internet works. It was a bit embarrassing to see the lack of understanding of that. It was frightening for many of us. However, there are some that do see that, and thus the pressures on Facebook, who now have changed some of their terms and conditions and have made some of the right things happen. But there's a tendency we have as humans to not, if we have the ability to go change our privacy, we don't. So think of the $10 a month thing you have on your credit card that you keep saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to fix that. And you don't. You just, it goes sometimes for years, right? Privacy is the same way. People don't necessarily take that opportunity to go change their privacy privileges, even if they have access. It's in our nature.
Yeah.
And Facebook enables you to do that, but they know we don't. And they also, you know, make it a little, you know, you have to go through a couple steps to do it. So it's not top of mind. And so you see the red button and then you go back and you're like, oh, now this is really good. I'm back. I get to see my cousin Jorge who's at the beach, right? Or whatever. So the responsibility is on us as marketers to hold them accountable. It's also us as consumers to be intelligent and to educate. And I think one of the things we need to do is educate our children like we educate them about sex and drugs. We need to educate them about privacy. This is one of the critical things us as parents, we need to not assume that that somebody else is going to do that. We have to take that as our own responsibility at the schools and as parents. But at the same time, you know that the kids are having the devices and they're out and about. So you need to be able to enable them to make smart decisions and to be mature in that regard. And that's something the government cannot
do. Hopefully. Well, we ran out of time. It's a fascinating conversation we're having with Jason Jerzinovich from Avas Media. Thank you very much, Jason. I hope you have a great time here in Chile.
And, appreciate your time. Thank you.
We expect to have you back again. Yep. Thank you very much.